This movie, Inception, I think is going to be a blockbuster and will get a lot of people interested in dreams, something that you've been looking at for a long, long time.
Right.
What do you think? You think it will?
Well, I will, yes. I think it gives us some very good talking points. It's created a buzz about dreaming. The buzz is sometimes not terribly clear or helpful, I must add, but it has got people talking about the possibility of dreaming. It would be a shame if people thought that lucid dreaming, shared dreaming, active dreaming, all this good stuff is a prerogative of the dark side of the force to be done by corporate hackers on drugs and with funny machines. I mean, the truth of the matter, George, is that shared dreaming, a phrase they use in the movie, isn't ancient technique. It is typical of shamanic indigenous dreaming traditions, which I have studied. I've been teaching shared dreaming and group dreaming for positive and healing and helpful purposes for over 20 years now. And when I use that phrase, I don't mean Leonardo DiCaprio going inside someone's brain to construct a mind trap that is going to make them do strange things. I'm talking about people learning to embark on a conscious, intentional dream journey together, starting out lucid, staying hyper-lucid, going to an agreed destination, going to a place of healing, solving something, and bringing back gifts. You see, that is the truth of shared dreaming. And the film enables us to talk about these things, but this is not, to put it mildly, what the film suggests. And frankly, you know, as a dreamer who is used to the fantastically colorful and interesting dreamscapes available to us, I was bored to death by these falling skyscrapers and this sterile sort of vertical icebox locale that they came up with. Hey, if we're going dreaming, can't we have a more interesting locale than those vertical iceboxes?
And, you know, we can use our dreams, as you know, Robert, to enhance your love life, to get a better job.
Yes.
It's just it's a miraculous tool, isn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly. Let me give you a quick example of a positive use of shared dreaming so we can put some light on this subject. A lot of people running around saying lucid dreaming this, lucid dreaming that, shared dreaming this, shared dreaming that. Let me give you a practical, simple account of how a couple in one of my workshops did shared dreaming together and produced fascinating results. Okay.
All right.
The guy's a senior executive in a corporation. He arrives with his wife. Unusual to get a couple together in a dreaming workshop, but here they were. Great. He's worried because he's dreamed that he is summoned for an emergency meeting at a house he does not recognize on the beach. He suspects he does not know. He suspects that that strange house in the dream is his boss's second home on the beach. He's not sure. He knows in the dream that his job is on the line, he's probably about to be fired, and he's worried. So I say to him, George, his name is George too, I would love you to go back inside this dream consciously. He says, how am I going to do that? I say, I'm going to use this gee whiz piece of primal technology, a simple frame drum, a shaman's drum. I'm going to beat on it very steadily, and the drumming is going to help you get back inside the dream so you can figure out what the heck is going on and what you need to do to save your job. And I say to him, George, I'd like you to take a partner with you in shared dreaming to go into the same dream space with you and get some practical results. He picks his wife. I'm not altogether thrilled that he's picked his wife, but I'm interested and I'm not going to stop them. So now I'm drumming and couples together in the workshop. Picture 30 or 40 people relaxed in easy chairs or cushions or on the floor, journeying together on this kind of assignment. This George gets back into the house on the beach. He goes through the whole house. He finds out what the problem is at the office, something going on behind closed doors he doesn't otherwise know about. His wife is there with him, George. They're together in a hyper-lucid dream, a shared dream, wide awake and conscious. And when they come back from this journey, they talk as if they've been on a real estate tour. You know, he's a guy. He's looked at the deck. He's checked out aspects of the house, the den, the recreation room, things that appeal to the guy. She's better on the kitchen and the bathrooms. But between them, they could have designed the house. They've been there in that detail. The upshot is this, George. 6 months later, when the crisis that he dreamed about 6 months ahead of time erupts at the office, George has made the right moves to save his job, so he's sitting on the right side of the table when he's summoned to an emergency meeting at the boss's beach house. His job is safe. He's there, unfortunately, to rule on other people who'll be losing theirs. Oh. The second thing accomplished is, George, he doesn't need to ask where the restroom is because he's been there in his
country. He already knows.
See, this is the kind of thing that people need to know. This is experiential stuff. I'm a pragmatist. Adventist. I'm not some New Age mystic soap bubble a guy. I'm a guy who comes from a very practical tradition. That is the ancient Paleolithic tradition. I'm a Stone Age guy, not a New Age guy. I come from those dreamers who know that this stuff can save your job and save your life, and that going into shared dreaming isn't about dark side corporate stuff and Pentagon plots. They might be going on. I'm not saying that they're not going
right,
on.
Right.
But I'm saying that there's a human, practical, life-supporting aspect to all of this, which unfortunately Hollywood directors have not yet been smart enough to give us on the movies.
Now, you, way before you became a dream teacher, Robert, you have been a history professor, or a correspondent, a foreign correspondent, an editor for a magazine, a best-selling novelist. How did you get interested in this?
Well, this is my life story. This is where I come from. I mean, I can hear I talk funny. I'm a boy from the bush. I grew up in Australia. The native people of my native country, the Aborigines, they say, George, that your personal dreams can take you into the dream time. That the dream time is not to be confused with the personal subconscious that psychologists are always telling us about. The dream time is the real world. It's the place which is at the origin of the events and situations that come about in our lives. It's a place where you meet the wise teachers and the ancestors who can show you what really matters. So the Aboriginal understanding is that through dreams, not just through sleep dreams, but through wide awake dreams and through listening to signs and synchronicities in the world around you, you can get into the dream time. So by osmosis, that's part of my upbringing. But what made it clear to me as a kid that all of this was extremely important was that I died a lot. You know, in those days, we didn't have Raymond Moody's term, the near-death experience. You know, that sounds sort of kind of respectable, but I rather prefer what an Australian doctor said when I was 9 years old to my parents. He said, oh, the poor kid, he died and he came back, didn't he? I mean, I lost vital signs for several minutes in a Melbourne hospital when I was 9 years old. I went in for an emergency appendectomy. I'd been in the previous week for double pneumonia. I was a very sick kid at that time. And when they were starting to operate on me, I had an experience which you've heard about from other people, and this part of it is not unusual. I found myself floating up under the ceiling, looking at the scene of a 9-year-old kid with blood and scalpels and nurses talking and not wanting to be there. And I wander out of the operating theater, George, and I wander down the corridor, and there's my mother sobbing, and I don't want to share her pain. I know how worried she is. I want to do what regular kids want to do. I want to go to the beach. I want to go to the theme park, you know, down the beach. Luna Park just for fun. So I find myself, without thinking about what's going on, going through the window, going down the beach. I've forgotten I've left my body in the operating room. There's the big moon face entrance of Luna Park, the Australian theme park. And I go through the entrance thing. I look at the girls. I ride on the trains. I go on the rides. I don't have to pay for a ticket. And suddenly there's traction, and I'm not exactly on the ghost train that I've boarded. I'm sucked down into the earth. And, George, I'm welcomed by people who are humanoid, but not quite like us. They're very elegant, they're very thin, they're very tall, they're very pale, they're beautiful, they welcome me as one of their own. And I seem to spend the life of a man for maybe 90 years among them. I become a father, a grandfather, an elder of their society. Then my body is used up, and they cremate me, and I float up on the smoke, and I think I'm going to their afterlife, but I'm drawn back into the body of a sickly 9-year-old boy on an operating theater in Australia, and I remember this. And I remember this. Jeez. And it's very hard to talk about this kind of thing to the adults around me in a conservative era in Australian society. And I'm an army brat. I'm from a military family. You didn't talk about this kind of thing recklessly.
Right.
And the first person I met who understood this kind of thing that I could safely talk to was an Aboriginal kid who said, oh, yeah? Matter of fact, you see, not mystical. Oh, yeah, we do that. We get sick. We go to a special place with the Mimi spirits. And when we get well, we come back. That was the first explanation I received of what had happened to me. But you see, George, if you've had this kind of experience in childhood, there's been no safe way of talking about it to your teachers or your parents or your family. You learn to lay low for a while. So I was quiet about the dreaming for a long time in my life, but I used it. It kept me alive when I was a war correspondent in Vietnam. I would be dead on a road outside Phnom Penh if I hadn't listened to a dream. The photographer I had a date with that morning is dead because he wouldn't hear the dream, but I did. So in all of my roles in life, as journalist, as professor, as a thriller writer, as teacher today, I have used the dreaming, but I reached a point in my life when it became essential because of my own visionary experiences to go public and help people to claim the gifts of the dreaming that are waiting for them. It's time. We need this. It's of the most urgent and vital importance that we become dreamers again in the full sense of the word. Our planet needs it. Our humanity needs it.